Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a live recording from Rosalind Packer Theatre at the 2017 Festival.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival. My name is Sophia Stefanovic, and I'm very excited to be talking to Henry Marsh today. So Henry Marsh is a writer and one of Britain's foremost brain surgeons. His first memoir, Do No Harm, was celebrated for giving a human voice to the mysterious and intimate practice of brain surgery. Almost 40 years since the beginning of his career, Henry has written Admissions, which is a reflection on his work, his recent retirement, the nature of life and death, and the mysteries of our minds. And I'm very excited to be chatting about all those things today in the space of an hour.
Nothing very much.
That's all. Before we finish, I'll take some questions from the audience, and we're also live streaming this event. So for the first time, Sydney Writers Festival is live streaming to all states and territories. So we've got people listening all over Australia, which is very nice. Please silence your phones. So Henry, I have been a fan of yours since I saw the documentary about you, The English Surgeon, which is this wonderful film that follows you to the Ukraine. Where
made by an Australian, I should.
Made by an Australian. I didn't even know that.
To point out, yeah.
There you go. Mm. We're very good at those things. It follows you to the Ukraine where you do these very complicated operations, and you actually do an awake craniotomy. Is that what it's called? That's when you operate, you take off someone's skull and operate on their brain while they're awake.
Yes.
And not only was I sort of taken and fascinated by the work that you were doing itself, but actually by you as a person. So I was really fascinated. I guess you come across as very human and emotional. And when I think of people who, if I imagine someone who's going to operate on my brain, I imagine someone with a very, for lack of a better word, clinical personality who's just going to go in there and I don't imagine them kind of going through all these emotions that you seem to, and I was very interested in you as a person. Do you think you're an atypical brain surgeon?
Well, the answer to that has to be yes, to the extent I've written about it in a rather relatively open way, and the first book was very successful. But the fact it's, I think the book... Books, I have to say now, have been also actually rather successful with the medical profession. And it's been particularly successful in America. And I was terribly hesitant about what my American colleagues would think. I thought they'd all think. The book is the first book, and also in a sense the second book, is more about failure than about success. I do try to balance it a bit and talk about successful operations, because on balance, far more patients have benefited from the work I've done than have come to harm. But the ironical title of the first book, Do No Harm, refers to the fact you have to accept, if you work in a very dangerous branch of surgery, as brain surgery is, you are going to damage some patients. And sometimes it'll be your mistake. You know, one's a human being. But in fact, the Americans, I got a lot of emails and letters from very senior American neurosurgeons, but mainly retired, who said they loved the book, which I think was significant. A, that I was saying things that actually applied to American neurosurgery as well, although being America, there's an awful lot of hype, and it's very difficult in America for a doctor to actually stand up in public and say, I get things wrong. And with the fact they were retired also, I felt, showed something I knew already, is that, you know, as a neurosurgeon, you're on a sort of tightrope. And in the words of that great B.B. King song, if you want to keep on flying, you better not look down. And it's only when you've retired you can actually admit how difficult the work can be. And what's difficult, there's this myth about brain surgery. People think it's terribly exquisite technically. Well, I like to be a bit over the top and say brain surgery isn't very difficult, really. Or at least I don't think it's any more difficult than other branches of surgery in terms of what you do with your hands. In fact, some, like microvascular plastic surgery or heart surgery, we have to stitch cardiac valves in very quickly because the patient's on bypass, probably actually require greater manual dexterity. But what's so special about brain surgery is it's so dangerous. And it's dangerous because the brain is so complex and so delicate, and the brain doesn't heal itself. You can't stitch the brain up in the way you stitch up heart muscle or screw bones together. It has very limited powers of recovery. So it's very dangerous, and that means the decision-making is critical and very difficult, because any surgical decision, superficially, it sounds simple. You say, these are the risks of surgery and benefits of surgery, these are the risks and benefits of not operating. And occasionally it's very obvious. If you don't operate, the patient's going to die. If you do operate, they're going to make a complete recovery and be fine. But most of the time, it's not like that. Most of the time, it's you're balancing probabilities. Well, you know, the risks of the operation are 10% risk of death or disability. And then if the risk of your coming to harm if you don't have the operation is this. And we know from a lot of work over the last 20 or 30 years, some cognitive scientists, the psychologists now call themselves, we are very bad at estimating probability, at dealing with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. We have what are called cognitive biases. And a surgeon's liable to that. Because if I say these are the risks of surgery, what that means is surgery in my hands, not what the great professor has said in his lectures or in the textbooks. And how good am I at remembering when things have gone badly? So in fact, the precision of the actual operating is not matched by a precision in decision-making. The decision-making often is actually pretty vague. And I try to illustrate this in my books with various stories of operations, some of which went wrong and some went well.
And you also talk about, which I think is fascinating, you talk about the sort of constant arguments you have to have with yourself as well. So I think that we assume, those of us who are on the patient side more than on the surgeon side, that you just know what you're doing and that the decision you're making, that you know what the correct decision is, and that it's very black and white. But you actually talk about how it's not, but it does require this certain, you know, surgeons are known for being arrogant, and you say that that's often true because you need to be, because you need to exude, firstly, your patients need to feel at ease. So if you're, say, crying before the operation, that's probably bad, yeah. Right?
No, exactly. I mean, there's nothing more frightening for a patient yes. than an anxious doctor. And I like to illustrate this. It was my wife, my second wife, is an anthropologist called Kate Fox, and she's written a best-selling book, some of you may know, called Watching the English. And it's a very, very clever, very witty account of why us English people are all a bit odd, you know, and socially inept. But she has Crohn's disease, and it's quite often in hospital. And she told me recently how she'd gone up to the hospital in Oxford to have her blood taken. I brought back memories when I was a junior doctor, and you sort of leave a train of bruises and pinpricks up the patient's arm. I'm sure some of you have had this experience. And of course, actually, this is a profound ethical problem for the inexperienced young doctor. At what point do you stop sticking needles into the patient's arm and ask somebody more experienced than yourself to come and help? And this is a problem you face, in fact, throughout your surgical career until you're very senior. If you don't take on the difficult cases, how are you ever going to get any better? Anyway, so this young doctor was leaving a load of bruises and pinpricks up Kate's arm, and then what did he say? He said, I'm terribly sorry, I haven't done this very much before. And as Kate said, I wish he hadn't said that.
Yeah.
So in fact, you know, what he should have said was, you've got terrible veins, it's all your fault. So it's a very important principle in medicine, when things go wrong, always blame the patient. what this means is, I mean, it's an odd truth, but actually we have to deceive patients to some extent, because you have to give them hope. And to get that balance right can be very difficult. And of course, the best way of deceiving other people is to deceive ourselves. So all I like to say, slightly tongue-in-cheek, that self-deception is a very important clinical skill for all doctors. And it's kind of okay when you're a junior doctor, because in theory there'll be more senior doctors sort of keeping your ego and self-deception in check. But once you become a senior doctor and you're more or less independent in your decision-making and your advice to patients, you know, we all know examples of, particularly of surgeons, where it gets out of control and the self-deception, it reinforces itself. And there are all sorts of ways in which doctors can hide bad results from themselves and not admit to mistakes. And of course, the point is, everything in life, we learn most from mistakes. In a funny sort of way, success is bad for us. It makes us complacent and pleased with ourselves. And if you don't recognize your mistakes, you're not going to get better. But the problem in medicine, and particularly for brain surgeons, is the consequences of our mistakes for our patients are so terrible, both for the patient and for ourselves and medico-legal and everything else, we do tend to develop blinkers, and it's very difficult to admit to them, and it's a big, big problem. And the other point is, just like, you know, you want to give patients hope, and it may the situation may be pretty hopeless, and you have to tell patients the truth, but somehow help them cope with it and be more optimistic and positive, perhaps, than is the case. But the other point is anxiety is contagious. And we all hate, I hate anxious patients. They make me feel anxious.
And do you get many relaxed
patients? So in the morning of a, well, patients on the whole, you know, they learn that they've got to be very grateful and docile and do what they're told. And much of what goes on in hospitals, and often the pretty grotty physical circumstances, is about controlling patients so they don't express their anxiety too much. I mean, it varies from culture to culture. I mean, I work a lot in Nepal, in Kathmandu, and then if an operation goes badly, in fact, just 2 weeks before I was there last time, earlier this year, a patient had died, I think probably not due to a mistake from pulmonary embolism. And the family smashed all the hospital's windows, you know. So I've got colleagues in Karachi when I was there who said, no, Henry, it's very difficult to operate when the family are outside the operating room doors with Kalashnikovs saying they'll kill you, you know. And in fact, 500 doctors have been killed in Pakistan in the last 3 years for a variety of reasons. So I tell my American colleagues, they're always complaining about litigation, you don't know how lucky you are.
But, you know, I think it's a really interesting point that you say that you need to have this certain, and you actually describe it as you need to stop having empathy for your patients to an extent before an
empathy
operation.
Empathy is a bad thing. If you mean by empathy, actually feeling what
yeah,
your patients
Yeah, and identifying with them or something. But you are an empathetic person.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Is it that you feel empathy and then you just cut off from it when you're about to operate? Or how do you do that?
I think the answer is, you know, we have a great... It's a hard thing to put into words, but we all have developed sort of split consciousness or cognitive dissonance. And you have all these, and in my second book, I try to illustrate this a bit and discuss it, how we have all these competing selves. And there's extraordinary work, some of you will know, on people who have had the corpus callosum, the main connecting pathways between the two halves of the brain. And had it divided in the past for epilepsy. It's an operation we only do occasionally now for a particular form of epilepsy. And you can set people up in an experimental setting where you have a dividing wall here. So the two halves of the brain see different images. And then you can show people actually end up, because the speech on the left side can't communicate directly with knowing how to do things, how to use things. And you can actually end up where people are confused. One half of the brain wants to do one thing, the other half does another thing. It is said that one of his patients with a split brain once wanted to hit his wife with his, I think, with his right hand, and he then restrained himself with the left hand, you know?
So this is what's going on in your mind when you're operating, basically.
So I think we underestimate the extent to which our conscious self is bouncing around. And they said, empathy, if you mean by empathy of it, you feel what the patient is feeling. You can't do it. I was operating on a 3-year-old child 2 weeks ago in Ukraine with a tumour. And I've got a 3-year-old granddaughter who I'm totally besotted by. And if I felt for the child I was operating on the way I felt for my grandchild, you obviously couldn't do it. But somehow you have to maintain your humanity in the process and have what I like the phrase of rational compassion. You have to think what this is like for the patient and their family and react accordingly. And this is difficult. And the other problem is that in most healthcare in hospitals is handed out by young doctors and nurses who have no personal experience. I speak for myself of what it's like to be ill, what it's like to be in a hospital. And it's one of the reasons why hospitals are often such extraordinarily unpleasant places. And again, my anthropologist's wife, I've been working in hospitals for years before I met her. We've been together now for 17 years. And she pointed out to me something I'd never really appreciated. For the last thing, I was talking about this, about hospital architecture at the festival 2 days ago. The last thing you get in hospital is peace, rest, or quiet. And any of us who've been patients know that. Mm. They're noisy, they're brightly lit, they're uncomfortable, they're physically undignified, even if you're in a room on your own. And yet it's so obvious that if you're ill, if you're recovering from an operation, peace, rest, and quiet are important. Yeah. And yet, because we've developed this blinkered view where we don't want to feel what patients feel, for understandable reasons, we lose track of some very important truths. And there's nothing inevitable about bad design. I mean, hospitals can get around this problem with much more sympathetic design, but it doesn't happen.
And most people nowadays die in hospital, right?
Well, in England, more than 50% do.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And yet they are in these terrible environments, yeah. as you say.
Yeah.
So why are they like that? Are they like
it's
factories?
Partly financial. If you go to America, where I was earlier this week, I mean, some of the hospitals are like luxury hotels. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely surreal. I was at the MD Anderson Hospital in Houston, which it's a mecca for cancer. And the budget for that one hospital, that's a series of big buildings, is $4.6 billion a year.
You
know?
Wow.
so some of it's financial, but it's still this. There's this sort of spiritual power element to it as well. Mm-hmm. The patients are the out-group. You know, human beings, our brains have developed in hunter-gatherer groups 100,000 years ago. We still have Stone Age brains, basically. And a fundamental aspect to our nature is, and this all comes from my anthropologist's wife, is, you know, the in-group and the out-group. And when you become a doctor, as opposed to being a medical student, you learn that patients actually are part of the out-group. Mm. And that's something you have to struggle against to some extent. I had the unusual experience of my infant son, who's now alive and well at the age of 37, had a brain tumour when he was 3 months old. He's not... probably the main reason why I became a brain surgeon myself. But this was right at the beginning of my medical career, and I don't know what sort of doctor I'd have been if I hadn't had that experience, but I certainly had direct personal experience of being a relative, a parent of a child who almost died with a brain tumour. And I suspect it helped me a bit, as I say jokingly in my first book, doctors can't suffer enough. There's no substitute for personal experience. And it's a common observation by doctors as they get older and become patients themselves or have members of their family, that they say, I didn't really understand what my patients were going through until it happened to me. But again, when you're a young doctor, you're so anxious to learn to learn how to operate, to learn the technical aspects to it. You don't really want to get too involved in the more emotional part of it.
And you have become more involved in that as your career has gone
on. Well, I probably have. I mean, it's we only remember our past selves in accordance with what we want to remember now. Yeah. And and the basis of both my books is a diary. I write a diary every day, I have done, since the age of 13. I was so embarrassed by it when I was 22. I destroyed it all in a bonfire in the back garden. It's all literally auto da fe. But that was the basis of the book. So that's why I'd like to think, but there's a certain immediacy to what I write, because it's actually all a version of what I wrote when things were happening. And again, it comes back to my wonderful wife, because she'd asked me, this is my second wife, Kate Fox, she'd asked me what I was doing at work today, and I'd sort of pull out my laptop and read of what I'd written. And she said, that ought to be a book. So that's how the books came about.
And the books, yeah, they're very interesting, because you describe kind of case studies in a lot of detail, and you do give us an insight into what it might be like to be a patient, as well as what it's like from your perspective, which is the part that we don't usually have any access to. And I found it interesting. I'm really interested in the things you say about hospitals and how interesting ways of describing them. You call them like a limbo between heaven and hell, and how busy hospital wards are unfortunate places to die. And I find that interesting. And I also find really interesting your problems you have come across with bureaucracy that has changed in your career and what it was like when you were a young doctor working very long shifts to what it's like now. And in fact, you described this scene in one of your final days working at your hospital in London that ended with quite a kind of unfortunate incident, which I wanted to ask you to describe, if you don't mind.
It was wonderful. I'll try to make a long story a little shorter. I'd done a particularly difficult operation. It was one of the last ones I was doing at the base of this man's brain, which in principle could involve the nerves coming off the brainstem for swallowing, technically a foramen magnum meningioma. And the operation went fine. It was bloody difficult, literally bloody. It played like a stuck pig, the tumour, so it was very difficult.
All this in the book, you can
go and so it went fine. And at the end, I couldn't really see what I was doing until I actually removed the tumour, because I was operating down a microscope through a hole that size in a sort of puddle of blood. And you have to operate fairly quickly because a quarter of the output from the heart goes to the brain. And although it's very unusual, patients can actually bleed to death during a brain operation. It's very unusual, but I've had that problem twice, and it's terrible. Anyway, so I was having been pretty worked up about the op, it went fine. And I was quite certain afterwards when the patient woke up, although he had a hoarse voice because the nerve of the vocal cords was bruised, he could swallow, he could cough, so there was no risk of fluid in his mouth getting into the lungs. If there is, you don't let them drink and you put a nasal gas, rather unpleasant tube up the nose and then down into the stomach. So he didn't need a nasogastric tube. But I was very cross when I went back to see him that evening, because I'd always go in at night to see my patients after surgery, because I live more or less next door to the hospital. But that somebody put a nasogastric tube down his nose, which is a mistake, and it shouldn't have been done. But I thought, oh, it's 11 o'clock at night, so I'll sort it out in the morning. And I came back in the morning and told it's a different nurse, it was a male nurse. I don't think I'd have assaulted a female nurse. I might have done. And I said, take the tube out. And he said, no, Mr. Marsh, I can't. And I said, well, and there's some sort of protocol that nasogastric tubes should only be taken out after the patient's swallowing has been assessed by the speech and language therapist, so-called SALT. And I'm not the SALT team's favourite neurosurgeon in my hospital anyway. So I knew I was retiring in 2 days' time, and just sort of years of frustration and loss of authority. And I sort of grabbed him by the nose and said, I hate your guts. It was completely pathetic.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know, and in fact, and then I was summoned to see the matron next day, who actually was an old friend and knew I was retiring. And in fact, the nurse I'd assaulted was actually quite reasonable about it. He'd obviously been very upset. And he said, how now? I was very frightening, and I'm sure I was. But
he probably didn't expect to be grabbed by the nose.
No, I apologise profusely. I don't often lose my temper at work. But I'm a generation of surgeons who worked me. Some of them would lose their temper on a daily basis. You know, and there's one surgeon, like, whose junior I was, and when you assisted him at operating, you'd just be subjected to non-stop abuse.
Yeah.
Throughout the operation, and you kind of accepted that.
But that, I wanted to ask you, so about that bureaucracy, I feel like that was, it was a long time coming, the nose tweak. It was something that you had been frustrated by.
It was increasing. I'm not saying things were better in the past, but there's no question of that. 30 or 40 years ago, in English hospitals, doctors had much more authority. Mm-hmm. Too much, in many ways, in my opinion. But the pendulum's kind of swung back to the other way, where your subject were always separate. 40 years ago, there was one pyramid. Basically, the senior doctors were at the top, and then everything else was below them. Now you have a whole series of competing pyramids. You have a nursing hierarchy, the medical hierarchy, the managerial hierarchy, and it's chaos as a result. Nobody really is in charge any longer.
And you operate a lot less, right?
And also, partly because they'd increased the number of surgeons, which is not necessarily a bad thing, and also the world is changing, and my younger colleagues are not willing to work in the way I did in the past, which was operating 4 days a week, being on call every third weekend and every third night, and really having very little family life. And it's one reason why my first marriage ended. And I'm amazed my three children still seem to quite like me. I think I'm very lucky. So it's a combination of good and bad things. But it's swung to the other extreme now, and the other problem in England. In fact, there are not many healthcare systems in the world which are not in financial crisis to a greater or lesser extent, is that healthcare is getting more and more expensive because we're all living longer, and cancer is basically a disease of old age, and there are lots of fancy pharmacological treatments for cancer now which don't necessarily cure it. They're immensely expensive. Medical technology gets more and more expensive. There are more and more old people with more and more diseases, and you have dementia as well. So everywhere in the world, healthcare costs are rapidly rising way above the rate of inflation. But in England, because it's a tax-funded system, which ultimately I think is better than private, commercial, competitive healthcare, the government won't dare to tell the public you need to pay more because they don't want to put taxes up because then you won't win the election. So there's this fundamental flaw with socialised healthcare in democratic societies that they tend to be underfunded, and the NHS in England is struggling. You know, we have longer and longer queues, but then the government imposes targets. So you've got to meet these targets, and you end up in situations. Again, coming back to my wife and her Crohn's disease, she was admitted some years ago as an emergency, underwent emergency surgery, fine, no problem. She then needed several weeks of intensive care and intravenous feeding because she was so underweight, and now needed a bigger definitive operation on her gut. But now she was no longer an emergency. And so she was prepared for surgery 5 days in a row, major surgery, with a risk of an ileostomy afterwards and pretty nasty things like that. And every day it was cancelled because I think they had more important routine cases to do. So I rang up the professor's secretary in despair and said, look, will she ever have her operation? And the secretary said, well, you've got to ring up the list broker who actually decides who's operated on, who's a manager. So I rang up the list broker and said, ring, ring. The mailbox is full. You cannot leave a message. So eventually they sent Kate home with a family-sized bottle of morphine and made her into a routine case so she could then be put on the routine operating list and have the operation. Now, if that happens to me, and I'm not saying my wife should get better treatment because I'm a senior neurosurgeon, far from it. But as one of my colleagues in that hospital said, well, if we're going to do this to our colleagues' wives, what about the average man in the street? Yeah. And this shows you these bizarre distortions you get when you try increasingly to squeeze the medical system to save money. And it's very demoralising.
Yet you, even though obviously you have these criticisms and the system isn't perfect, you're actually very... also critical of the private system in your particular field of surgery.
Yeah, and I've worked all over the place, and I don't work in America, but I'm a professor in Seattle. I've trained a lot of Americans who came to work in my department in London. And the trouble with private healthcare is if you introduce profit seeking into healthcare, you could end up with fantastic, luxurious hospitals. I mean, if you go to Northwestern in Chicago, they've got a luxury bar and restaurant on the roof. So I'm not sure who it's supposed to use it, whether it's passers-by or relatives or the doctors. It's extraordinary. It's a sort of peacock's tail of competition in the American healthcare system, because America spends twice as much per capita than any other country in the world on healthcare. But the problem is you introduce profit-seeking, and you end up with a lot of unnecessary investigations, unnecessary surgery. And there's no question that happens. And particularly in third-world countries, where state healthcare is usually impoverished because people don't want to pay tax and the governments are corrupt. And obviously you don't want to pay taxes if you know it's going to go into the politicians' pockets. Mm. So a lot of these poor countries, there's more and more private healthcare, but it's unregulated. And although there are lots of good doctors, there are lots of slightly less good doctors. And again, as I said earlier, the surgical decision is not straightforward. It's about probabilities. So you don't necessarily have to be corrupt and venal to start being influenced by the fact you make money by doing more operations. So fee for service, as they call it in America, I think is terrible. If you pay doctors the more work they do, they'll find more and more patients to operate on. A good example is when the last Labour government in England threw money at the NHS, some of which was wasted, some of it wasn't. But they set up sort of private surgical clinics to try to get rid of the enormous waiting lists which had accumulated. And this is particularly the case in ophthalmic surgery for cataracts. Now, there are cataracts and cataracts. There are big cataracts and little cataracts. It's a question of judgment at what point you suggest surgery. I've had bilateral retinal detachments in my right eye. There's a lot of blood, old blood floating around. So I haven't got very good vision for distance vision in my right eye, but I put up with it. But it's all about judgment. So lo and behold, suddenly the Labour government found hundreds of thousands of cataract operations were being done, which hadn't been done before. And that was because people were being paid. The more cataract ops they did, the more were done. So it's a difficult balance to establish. And my gut feeling is that private healthcare is more expensive than state healthcare. Of that was no doubt. And the problem is how to get the balance right, and it's very difficult. No easy answers.
And particularly, I think in your field where you talk about the need to have a certain, I mean, in a way, you have to act like a god, right? So you've got someone's literally brain in your hands. If you have a team of colleagues or people kind of not really checking up on you. I think that sounds wrong.
No, well, I mean, but if you're right. I mean, because of my experiences both in Ukraine and Nepal, where until recently in Ukraine, I was working with people who were working basically entirely on their own in terms of seniority. And people, you start making mistakes. And you don't. And I was watching somebody operate, I won't say who, and he made basically what I thought was a serious mistake. And actually, the patient died. And what was in. And that, you know, that happens. And I've had patients die. We all have. But what was fascinating afterwards was seeing the way he completely hid himself from the truth. He was upset about it. I mean, it was causing him problems. He wasn't happy. But the fact he'd clearly made a mistake, he came up with all sorts of alternative explanations, like the whole thing, you know, the operation was a success, but the patient died. So it's very easy to hide the truth from oneself. Ultimately, and this is a profound truth in Kahneman's great work, Thinking Fast and Slow, who got the Nobel Prize, is other people are better at seeing my mistakes than I am, because they haven't got my cognitive biases, my optimism bias, my hindsight bias, all that stuff.
And the self-deception that you say is important, that you have to have,
You have
right?
to have it. And the only way you can control it, really, is if you have good colleagues who will say, hey, hang on, you know. And ditto you to them. And that's a problem in surgery, because surgeons are all naturally egotists. Mm-hmm. We're usually sort of alpha male, competitive, driven people. And it doesn't come naturally to us to share things with colleagues. On paper we try in surgery, we have what are called mortality and morbidity meetings, where every month or so you're supposed to discuss all the bad results. And it can work very well. Though it depends very much on the quality of the person leading the discussion. And if you work in a department where all the surgeons hate each other, it just becomes, you know, backstabbing.
Chaos.
And if you work in a department where they all love each other too much, it's all, oh, don't worry, old boy, brush it under the carpet, you know. to get the balance right is quite difficult. But better than that, of course, in an ideal world, is if you can discuss difficult cases before the mistake is made. And I had a tragic disaster some years ago in Ukraine, where I took my colleague through a very difficult operation, really difficult, fantastic result. There's a young girl with I shouldn't say it, but I'm afraid surgeons, we like operating on young women because it's so much more exciting if they do well. You know, we're biased, we have our prejudices. It's a terrible thing to say, but it's true. But anyway, so she did fantastically well, a very difficult case. For any neurosurgeons in the audience, a dominant medial sphenoid-wing meningioma, big one. And I went back to London, thought everything was fine. And 2 years later, I learned she'd died from some kind of weird infection, which my colleague had totally mismanaged. And it was a bit like Chernobyl, which is 60 kilometres north of Kiev, where I work. He'd obviously felt unable to tell me about it. But I was terribly angry, because, you know, why hadn't he consulted me? Why hadn't he told me? I'd have flown back, you know, to try to sort it out. Then I had to admit that I had had a similar problem when a patient of mine got a terrible infection after an operation. I eventually made the diagnosis, and she survived, but terribly disabled. And in retrospect, I'm quite certain, because I was puzzled, I couldn't understand what was going on. I'm sure if I'd actually gone to one of my colleagues and said, what do you think? They'd have seen immediately what was totally obvious afterwards, which I couldn't see at the time. Mm. So it is coming back to this problem. It is really very difficult, particularly when things have gone wrong after an operation, to see it clearly. Outsiders, or relative outsiders, good colleagues will see it much better. So the whole emphasis of my teaching of trainee surgeons nowadays is that, you know, good colleagues, it's obvious in a way, is terribly important for patient safety. Now, as patients, of course, we're so frightened, particularly if it's serious surgery, we want to invest our surgeon with these sort of godlike, heroic powers, and the idea that actually he's a fallible person is very unsettling. But all I can say is, if you need major surgery, the department to go for is one, not that you can find out easily, is one where the senior doctors get on well together and have a constructive working relationship.
It would be an interesting question to ask at your, like, and how do you get along with your colleagues?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, again, in a rational world, if the doctor-patient relationship was a simple consumer relationship, which it isn't, you would ask the surgeon, how many of his operations have you done? What are your results like? How many of us dare to ask that?
Who wants to hear that?
Because we don't want to disingratiate ourselves or query the doctor.
Or hear, I've done two and both have failed, or something like that.
So, I mean, that's a rational question to ask, but we don't do it. Not in England, anyway.
And you also said, I think it's very important, this point that you're making about colleagues and teams. I also feel like in your books that you really also take your failures on yourself, and that in some ways you're very hard on yourself. Oh, well, I don't know if it's hard on yourself, because it is a matter of life and death, and people have died. But you talk about learning from past failures, and you seem to carry those past failures and talk about them a lot.
Well, at the beginning of my first book, I quote this wonderful, I wish I'd written it myself, by the French surgeon Le Riche, who says all surgeons carry within themselves an inner cemetery, and it's a place to which they must go from time to time and think about their failures, and it's a place of great bitterness and regret. And we all have an inner cemetery. The idea that surgeons are psychopaths, in my experience, isn't true. I mean, I know one or two surgeons who have probably are slightly psychopathic. But you can compensate for that by going into private medicine, because if you go into private practice, if on the whole your patients don't do well, you won't make a lot of money. So I know one surgeon, somebody who trained me, in fact, who is pretty good, but that's because he's totally motivated by money. And he was very concerned his patient should do well, but purely for his reputation, not for the patient's sake. Right? But in general terms, it's not a good thing.
I have this very nice quote from you that I liked. I wonder where. Oh, yes. Just about your changing views. So I'm just going to take you back when you were starting. I mean, you've written this. You're taking me back, really. Mm. But you said that a long time ago you thought brain surgery was exquisite. And you said, I thought that brain surgeons, because they handle the brain, the miraculous basis of everything we think and feel, must be tremendously wise and understand the meaning of life. Yet in this book, where you're coming to the end of your career and considering your own mortality, among other things, you're still struggling with these questions about the meaning of life. And I just wanted to ask you about some of the questions that you ask yourself in this book as you're reflecting on your both life and career.
Yeah, well, I certainly, seeing the living human brain on a daily basis tells you nothing about what's important in human life, other than the fact it's horribly fragile, and even thought and reason is fragile. And it is a sort of central theme running through both the books, this extraordinary fact. But everything you're thinking and feeling at the moment between your ears, behind your eyes, is the electrochemical activity of nerve cells. It is, and I like to illustrate this by saying when you're doing an awake craniotomy, you've got the patient's brain exposed, you can see the patient's face, and I'll be talking to the patient. I mean, most of the talking is done by either a speech therapist or the way I did it by my anaesthetist. When you're looking at the brain, that's the real person. You can't understand that. And I once had where I was operating on the visual part of the brain on the back of the left, and there's a TV monitor which shows what I'm looking at down my microscope. So in principle, the patients can see their own brain, and I ask them, do you want to see your own brain? And most of them say no, but some say yes. And then I say, well, you're now one of the few people in the history of the human race that's seen their own brain. So this guy's left visual cortex was looking at itself on a TV screen. And you feel there should be the equivalent of acoustic feedback, sort of philosophical acoustic feedback. There should be a metaphysical explosion, but of course nothing happens. It's crazy. It is utterly extraordinary. And having seen this on a daily basis for 35 years, it's taught me nothing, but there is still a deep sense of wonder to that. And the fact that, you know, I'm a total physicalist, I think when we die, our brains die, and that's the end of me. But there is this deep sense of wonder that modern science has. We cannot even begin to explain how consciousness arises from matter. Now, some people think this is reductionist, and it turns us into robots or automata, but it doesn't. It elevates matter. I'm not saying the table can think, but it means we don't understand matter. And that I find rather consoling in a way.
I just wanted to add, for the awake craniotomy, the reason that it's done is so that people can react to certain things as you're operating. It's not just so for
not just done
a
for
philosophical
fun,
no, fun just, strange
it's not just
thing to
done
do.
To amuse the surgeon of the
it's
philosophical
you're
bent.
Observing
like
what they do. So you're getting them to move their hand or to say
the
they
the
feel.
The answer is it's for a particular type of tumour that grows in the brain itself. And therefore, it's not a solid tumour. It's an area of brain with tumour growing in it. So it's sort of like that. You've got solid brains, some more solid tumour, and a junction area where the cells are all muddled up together. And you can't really tell just by looking at it when you're removing tumour or whether you're removing functioning brain. It sounds a bit sort of throwaway to say you can actually remove certain bits of the brain without it seeming to make a difference to people. And it's true. To a certain extent. So it's particularly, you only use this way of operating when the tumour's near the speech area, which in most people is here, or the movement areas, which are here. I mean, for more complex things like personality and things, you can't assess that during an operation. So the idea is if you have the patient awake, you can use an electrical probe to stimulate the brain, which can produce movement or interfere with speech. And if you're, say, operating on the speech area, near the speech area, you keep the patient talking all the time or answering questions. You can do it in a sort of scientific way with scoring points, looking at pictures, or you just listen to them chatting. They need somebody who's good at keeping the patient talking. And then you get early warning when you're straying into what we call eloquent brain as opposed to silent brain.
Do they slow down their speech?
Yeah, they slow down or they start making mistakes, yeah. And the point about this is, the more in general terms, although when I started doing this almost 30 years ago, I was the first person, in fact, in Europe to do it, not in America. It was very controversial. But in general terms, with these particular tumours called low-grade gliomas, the more of a tumour you get out, the longer the person lives. I mean, it's quite complicated, but that's the idea. So it's worth doing. And in fact, when you explain this to patients, I never really had any problems persuading people this was the way to operate, although those of us all here who don't not threatened by brain tumours and major surgery, the idea seems quite outlandish. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a safer way of operating. And again, the point is the brain doesn't feel pain. If I pinch my little finger, it is an illusion that the pain's in the finger. It's not. By pinching the finger, I've sent an electrical message to my brain. My brain has a map, a model of my body in it, and it then creates the sensation of pain in response to the particular pattern of nerve impulse going up my arm. So a lot of what we think of as real is not a delusion, but it's an illusion. And that certainly the modern neuroscience way of looking at the brain is that we have a model of the world, and when we perceive something, we only pay attention to it if it's different from our expectation. And there's a very easy way of illustrating that is if you're walking up a staircase or down a staircase and there's one step more or less, or if you're on an elevator, when you're at the beginning and the end, the steps change in height. Mm-hmm. We find it terribly confusing. The step is not what we expect, and we have a moment of complete physical confusion. So the brain really is a device for predicting the future. And I mean, in terms of evolutionary theory, the most plausible explanation for the arisal or development of brains is it permits movement. Because if you're going to move, you want to predict what you're going to find so you don't waste time trying to react to it. So sense of futurity and thinking ahead is totally built into our brains. And it gets more confusing than that, because there's a famous experiment done years ago by an American neuroscientist called Libet, where you get people to press a button and at the same time you record electrical activity of the brain. I won't go, it's a simple experiment. But essentially you can show, and it's been repeated again and again, that the decision, the conscious decision to move your finger is anticipated, but the brain becomes electrically active before you decide consciously to move your finger. Mm. Nobody really quite knows how to explain that. And some people say the conscious self is just as an epiphenomenon. It's totally after the event. I find that hard to believe. But it is, the more you think about the brain in your own consciousness, and if you read a bit of popular neuroscience as I do, the more extraordinary it is.
Mm. I'm going to let the audience ask some questions. I'll just direct you to the mics. There's one here and one here. And if you stand up behind them so that we can see you, and there's one up here and one up there. I've also got, if you walk towards the mic, I've also got a question from our live stream audience for you, Henry. Can you draw any similarities between your work as a neurosurgeon and your beekeeping hobby?
No, not at all. I do make furniture as well as a hobby, and that's more difficult than brain surgery because the joints don't heal, so you've got to be more precise and more brute forces involved. No, I do, other than just, I love my bees. I didn't do it for the honey. It's a funny thing. I'm sure it's the same in Australia. If you talk to English doctors about selecting medical students, the last thing you want to say if you're being interviewed for medical school is, I want to help people. It all sounds a bit naive and touchy-feely, and you've got to say no, you've got to come up with something. It's so interesting or something or other. But it reflects the fact we find this very awkward and embarrassing, shows we have this sort of divided consciousness, that we have to be a bit inhuman and professionally detached. But actually, most of us became doctors because we like looking after people, and that's what motivates us. But we're slightly embarrassed to admit that. So I suppose because I love my bees, I like living creatures. I'm not saying my patients are like bees, but maybe there's a connection.
And before, I know that other people want to ask a question, but I just want to ask a very quick one. If you could, so you describe neurosurgery as an all-consuming love,
yes,
and how it's been such a passion for you. Now, though, if you could go back, or not go back in time, but now if you were choosing a career, would you choose neurosurgery?
I'm often asked that question. It's difficult to answer because neurosurgery has changed technically, profoundly. The most challenging, and most people go into neurosurgery because it's exciting and challenging and dangerous and heroic, but because you care for the patients. If you didn't care what happened to the patient after the op, it wouldn't be exciting. People wouldn't climb Mount Everest if there weren't 200 dead bodies already there. But the most difficult, exquisite operations in neurosurgery, which was something called aneurysm surgery, and also operating on certain small tumours, have been largely replaced by non-surgical methods. There's still a few technically very, very difficult, exquisite operations left, but it's become a much, sense, less challenging area. So all I can say is I have no regrets. My view of neurosurgery has changed a bit, but I think it is utterly fascinating. It's very rewarding. It comes at a high price in terms of when things go badly. And I wouldn't... But if would I go back to doing it? I don't know. I just don't know.
Let's take a question.
You sort of stole my question.
Oh, sorry.
Fine. My question really was, with the advances of stereoactic surgery, which is computer-assisted brain surgery, do you think that it's now neurosurgery is now moving into a science rather than an art?
No, because the decision-making still remains critical. And that Osler, the great, Sir William Osler, the great Canadian-American physician, who worked in the early years of the last century. I always find when doctors talk about the art and science of medicine, I thought it was a bit pompous and self-important. But what Osler said was, he said, medicine is an art of uncertainty and a science of probability. And that doesn't change. However good the techniques are, however good the robot, you have to decide what the robot should do. And that won't change. And of course, there's a paradox with medical progress. The more you spend on it, the more it costs. Because as surgery gets safer and safer, you start operating on patients whom in the past you wouldn't have operated upon, usually on the grounds of age or ill health. So the problem of the decision-making remains, and that is where the art is so important.
Okay, let's have one from up there.
You said earlier that you need to sort of deceive yourself in order to, and also the patient a little bit.
Yes.
And you need good colleagues. In your sort of experience, what do you do if your colleagues are deceiving themselves to keep on going beyond the boundaries of futility?
It's very difficult, is the answer. There have been lots of medical scandals in Britain over the last 20 years, where essentially surgeons were doing badly and were not reported by their colleagues or even by the Royal College. And it's very difficult, partly because we've all got guilty secrets ourselves. We've all had bad results for which we blame ourselves. And, you know, people in glass houses are reluctant to throw stones. And if you have too much transparency in medicine, you know, if you put doctors in greenhouses, they'll probably all clam up. So to get that balance, it's an imperfect thing. But if you have a colleague who is not doing well, and to some extent I had a colleague who wasn't very good, but what we in effect did was kind of sideline him, so we kept the amount of operating he did to a sort of minimum. But if you're actually going to try to get rid of a colleague or denounce them or something, it's very difficult. You need the burden of proof becomes very difficult, there's lots of trouble. And again, because we tend to often give the benefit with the trainees now, because there's such strong employee employment protection in England. You know, quite often we've had a few trainees who really were not suited to neurosurgery. But bizarrely, the benefit of doubt is given to the trainee rather than to the patient. So you end up with lots of moral problems like this. That was better in the past, in a way. I remember my old boss once saying to one particularly incompetent trainee, "Mr. Mosley, your services are no longer required. Out." And he was kicked off the ward round, and that was the end. And he was right, it was the right decision. But of course, it did lend itself open to abuse. So again, it's the complex problem of cost and benefit.
Okay, so let's take a couple more. So I can see there's lots of questions. If you can keep your questions just short and to the point. Can we have one from
up here? I'll try to keep my answers short and to the point, but I find that rather difficult, I'm afraid.
So I wanted to ask about the personal graveyard and whether it's the more tragic sort of mistakes that you make which stick with you most, or is it the sort of personal connection that you make?
The things that hurt most, if I choose to remember them, which I try not to do, are a few episodes where I spoke very badly to patients or their families. And of course, the problem is, I may have done it on many occasions, but never realized it. Something most people don't realize. It's very difficult to learn how to talk to patients because you get no feedback. You know, we get better at doing things in all walks of life. By doing it, we get criticism or praise or feedback, and then we do better next time. In terms of talking to patients, you get zero feedback. And if an operation goes well, you could be extremely rude and unpleasant, but the patients still think you're wonderful. So I think most doctors, and I'd include myself in this, we have a very rosy view of how good we are at talking to patients. Well, that's a problem.
Let's take a question down here.
Oh, hi, Henry. Thanks for a very entertaining session. I'm an anaesthetist, but I do wonder, looking at both your books, there's no mention of anyone with whom you felt comfortable to share your absolutely terrible professional trials and tribulations. Is that the sad truth?
Well, I shared it with the world by writing the books. yes, I think that probably is true, and I think that has changed a bit. I mean, I was operating in London 2 weeks ago and went to help the guy who has replaced me in my hospital. I still work there one day a week. And we did a difficult operation, which went perfectly. And then in technical terms, there was malignant brain swelling at the end, and the patient's dead now, which was terrible for my colleagues. They'd only been a consultant for 2 years. But I felt actually, because we did it together and because we could talk about it, I would hope the new, younger generation of surgeons are a bit better. I mean, you've got to be tough, you know? You don't want to start crying on your sleeve all the time. That you, if you do this sort of work, it's why the book's called Do No Harm. You have to accept there are going to be some terrible times. But it's very important it hurts. If it doesn't hurt, that's even worse. But you have to kind of live with that and move on. When I had bad results as a young consultant, I'd feel awful for weeks. As I got older, I'd still felt awful, but only for a few days. But it would be horrible if you stopped feeling bad about it. So I think we have to accept that. It does help if you have colleagues. They understand. Like nobody really, other than another neurosurgeon, understands what it's like to go on the ward round every day and see a patient who was fine before the operation and is now desperately damaged. I remember one person who trained me couldn't do it. He'd disappear for weeks. He wouldn't do a ward round. And the family would say, "Where is Mr. So-and-so?" And I'd say, I don't quite know. And he's not here, you know, whatever. So it is very difficult. But so again, it's a question of balance. When I was talking at this American meeting in Houston earlier this week, it was all about training and it's all about wellness now. And the Americans are waking up to the fact there's quite a high suicide rate in residents and they still do an 80-hour week in America. The neurosurgeons are anomalous. The neurosurgeons, partly because in America neurosurgeons are regarded as the acme of surgeons, which isn't the case in England. I don't know about Australia. So they were talking about having sort of playing softball and things like that, having what they called mandatory fun, is trying to... You can imagine ticking the box in the assessment of a department, you know, do they play departmental? So one of the program directors, a woman, said, "Well, we did ask our residents what they'd like to do, and they said rifle shooting," which was obviously probably a rather liberal, not a member of the NRA, she was rather embarrassed by, but that's what they did for team bonding. They went off to a gun range and fired off a few machine guns, I think.
I think that's a very good note to bring the discussion to an end. I'd just like to tell you guys, I'm sorry, we don't have time for more questions, but if you would like... Henry will be in the Ruth Cracknell room, which is here on the first floor, and he'll be signing books and chatting. I mean, I guess you can answer a couple of questions on the fly.
Depends how long the queue is.
Depends
if it's a short
the
queue, we can have a chat. If it's a long queue, the chat will have to be shorter.
Henry, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.